time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for October 20th, 2018. I know I promised you a brand new show this week. I didn't know I'd have a brand new cold and cough. So since my voice is only good for a very short period of time, I decided I'd record a short opening, a closing, and a few items of interest, and then offer up a couple of great encore interviews. I promise we'll be back with a brand new show next week. So let me begin with some items of interest. The week has been filled with interesting news, from a column in the Akron Beacon Journal by reporter Bob Dyer, who believes that a road diet in his town would make roads much less safe and would increase road rage, and I believe he is incorrect and is opinion writing without all the facts, to Ashton Lambie, the amazing cyclist from Kansas, who set a world record on the track. I read one of the best books of the season in one sitting, cover to cover, this week. Sometimes it pays to be sick. The book is titled Saving Lucy. It's by round-the-world traveler Ishbel Rose Holmes. It's an amazing story, not just about the dog, but about Ishbel's life and about what she's accomplished with the work she's doing in Turkey. She'll be a guest on the show soon. In the What Is He Thinking category, 52-year-old Italian retired pro racer Andrea Tafi, I said 52, is considering rejoining the Peloton to race at Paris-Roubaix in 2019 to commemorate his 20 years since his win in 1999. Tafi retired from racing in 2005. Now all he needs is a team who wants him. On a little more serious note, the first transgender woman to win a race crossed the finish line this week, and there have been many comments, questions, and some heated debate about it all over the interwebs. Dr. Rachel McKinnon won the Masters World Championship in the match sprint in the women's 35 to 44-year-old age category. She's heard all the complaints, discussions, and arguments, both for and against her, and answers them in a great interview with journalist Fred Dreyer from Velo News in the October 15th online edition of the zine. Finally, I need to and I want to mention the Philly Bike Expo. I wasn't able to talk with director Bina Belinky-Trahan this year. She's crazy busy, and I can't talk for a few minutes without rudely coughing in her ear. But the expo is next weekend, October 27th and 28th, at the Philadelphia Convention Center. PBE has become the show on the East Coast, and this year the exhibitors list goes from Abus to Zip, with dozens and dozens of others in between. The seminar schedule is chock full, and you can learn about everything from pinstriping, wheel building, and how to ride a tandem, to advocacy and your rights as a cyclist on the road. If you're interested, you can go to phillybikeexpo.com, learn about the event, and purchase tickets. Let's get on with the show. I've chosen what I hope are a couple of great encore presentations for you this week. You may or may not have heard them when they first aired, but sometimes revisiting a topic might be interesting too. We've actually played the first interview as an encore in the past. It's been a few years, and while things have changed for Gary Helfrich out in Sonoma, he hasn't changed. He's still the great, amazing guy he's always been. And today, maybe even yesterday, Gary's going to arrive in Philadelphia for the expo on a bike that was built for him by two of the builders who will be exhibiting at the expo. He took a plane from Sonoma to Pittsburgh. He assembled the bike. He got on the bike, rode the C&O Pittsburgh to D.C. trail. He then left D.C. and rode to Philly. You'll get to know him and all the amazing things he's done and said when you hear his original conversation from 2011 in a moment. Then we're going to revisit a conversation with author and planner Jeff Speck. His seminal book, Walkable City, came out in 2013, And had Mr. Dyer of said Akron Beacon Journal read it, he might just understand how important it is to rethink what a downtown looks like. But we'll let Jeff tell you instead. So here's my 2011 interview with Gary Helfrich. Gary Helfrich, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you. My partner Brian says, you got to talk to Gary Helfrich. He's really an important guy.
So I'm glad. He and my mother both believe that.
Yeah, see? It's important to have a couple people in your camp. So I need to confess that after doing preliminary research, I didn't even know where to begin. You have done so many things. So I'm going to start with what you're doing now, and then we'll kind of backtrack into some of the fun things you've done in the past. So tell us a little bit about you and BikeSonoma.org.
Okay. Currently, I'm the executive director of Sonoma County Bicycle Coalition, and that's known around here as Bike Sonoma. And I've only been doing this for 6 months.
Oh.
So I'm relatively new to this. This is kind of a new phase in my life. I was the county transportation planner for 6 years before that.
So Sonoma is, just put it in space, where in California is the Sonoma area?
It is on the coast.
Okay.
We grow a little bit of wine here. People
yeah.
probably know about that.
Yeah, I do.
And it's a moderately large county that begins about 50 miles north of San Francisco.
Okay.
Runs up to Mendocino.
Beautiful country.
It is.
Which
it
means
is.
There's good cycling up there.
There's phenomenal cycling here.
Okay. So what exactly is your role with the organization? What do you do, actually? And what does the organization do?
What I do as director, I'm the administrator. I make sure that I find money for us to run our organization. I work with Sandra Lupien, who is our outreach director, on our position on various advocacy issues. And I work with the cities. There's 9 cities in this county, and the county on implementing the projects that are in their bicycle plans.
Okay, so how did you get involved with this? And then we'll back into what you did before, which is just amazing to me, all the things you've done.
Well, I got laid off from the county.
Aha!
Well, a more serious answer to that is I made a decision, and this had nothing to do with bicycling, but I got very, very, very involved in local government. And went back to college, got a degree in planning, and got the position with the county as the county's transportation planner. So I did the plan for our road network, for our airports. I did the airport land use master plan. I wrote the bicycle and pedestrian plan. Worked with SMART, which is a project to reestablish rail transit here. So Sonoma County has the biggest city in the United States, Santa Rosa, that's ever lost rail service.
Oh, man.
So that kind of puts us in it.
That's an interesting place to be, yeah.
And it's an interesting statistic. I didn't realize that Santa Rosa was the biggest city to lose rail service. And we've recently reestablished freight service, and we're working on passenger. And the unique thing about this, where it fits into my current job, is this is the first time ever anywhere that someone has proposed a rails with trails project to bring back a railroad.
What a great idea. We have something here in the Cuyahoga Valley where you can throw your bike on the train and then ride the towpath nearby, but certainly not on a scale that I think you're talking about.
This would let you go from Cloverdale in the north end of our county all the way down to the ferry to San Francisco.
Nice.
That's 70 miles, and it's a parallel path about 50 feet away from where the train is running. And the train will carry your bike as well, so you can get on and off any place you want and ride your bicycle along the same route that the train takes.
Well, all those tracks are still there, right?
The tracks never got torn up.
Okay.
And we were fortunate there, but often what happens with abandoned rail lines is you get rid of the rail and
uh-huh.
just put a bike path in.
Okay, so it converts rails to trails. That's what that
right,
program
is. Right, but this is rails with trails.
I think that's such a
that's
cool
really
idea.
That's really unique.
That is unique, and it's a great idea. Now if they could just do rails, trails, freeways, We'd be in great shape.
Well, we are doing a freeway with trails project. Funny you should ask.
Funny I should ask. That's great. So is this another, like, only place in the country?
No, this has been done in other places, and it often happens for the same reason. We have an old, outdated freeway that, to get the federal money that we need, has to be realigned. And so rather than just throw out the old pavement, the old alignment will become a dedicated bike and pedestrian path, and the new freeway will go its happy way. What makes this interesting is it's an area that has so few connections that legally you can ride your bike on the freeway because there isn't any alternative to get between these two cities in Novato and Petaluma. You literally have to ride your bicycle on the freeway.
Okay.
It's kind of exciting.
Yeah. It's kind of terrifying, too. Oh, Greg says it's common in the West, that is not an unusual situation.
It's true.
Okay.
And as somebody, you know, I grew up in Boston.
Right.
I was kind of terrified by it, but it turns out, especially once I began to work for the county and had access to our accident statistics, it's statistically extremely safe. You just have to get used to trucks flying by at 75 miles an hour while you're riding your bike.
Yeah, I guess. How many lanes? Are we talking a regular freeway, like six lanes?
Three lanes in each direction.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, then. Interesting. Obviously, bicycle and pedestrian issues are part of what you're doing. Are you also getting involved with legislation, what's going on in Washington at all?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
we're involved at I guess I'd say in California, it's all four levels. There's national, there's state, there's regional, which is unusual. California has these councils of government that create transportation regulations and disperse money regionally, and then at the local level as well. So, yeah, and I'm a little bit disturbed that our normally very liberal Senator Barbara Boxer caving in.
We reported a little bit on that this week. That's where they were marking up the transportation bill. What did she say? What is she caving to?
Well, Boxer is certainly one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate. And when the Republicans praise something that she's doing,
You get suspicious.
I get uneasy, you know, or if John Boehner says that she has an excellent proposal, which was also said, that doesn't sit well. And I don't, you know, we're still trying to figure out what the heck happened.
Me too. I've been reading it all this week and still can't figure it out.
Because transportation funding is only a couple of percent of the whole federal budget,
right,
all transportation put together. And bicycle and pedestrian is 1% of that. You're not talking about an amount of money that's more than, say, a rounding error in the defense budget.
Right.
or that could keep Social Security going for more than 15 minutes.
Exactly.
It's not enough money to make a difference. It's not as if bike and ped projects were preventing roads from being improved.
Right.
Well, we're going to be having a talk.
Are you? Good. Good for you.
The California Bike Co. We have a statewide umbrella organization that's very, very good at lobbying, and they'll be meeting with Senator Boxer just to see what the heck happened.
So I just want to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Gary Helfrich, who's out in Sonoma County, and now we're going to back a little bit into who he was before he became the director of the organization, BikeSonoma.org. So you aren't from the West Coast. You already said you were from Boston. Tell us what...
Even worse, I grew up in New Jersey.
New Jersey?
Yes. I grew up in a suburb of Newark.
Okay.
Which was kind of New Jersey's answer to Detroit.
Nice. Greg's laughing. I'm not so sure that's a good thing to say. So,
we have listeners in both those places, Diane, so just be careful.
Okay.
I enjoyed growing up there, and I learned never to trust air that you can't see.
Okay. That's a good one. I like that one. So I'm going to ask you what brought you to the coast and how you ended up leaving that area.
Well, I've always been at the coast.
West Coast. Sorry. The left coast. How's the left coast?
Newark has got a harbor. And
you're
so
right.
Does Boston.
You're right. Of course it does.
It was more just to get some distance from some business partners that I had.
Got it.
We had to split up. We were all pretty young, all of us who started Merlin, which was a company that built titanium bicycles.
We're going there.
But, you know, we weren't really ready to run a business. So the partnership fell apart.
Okay.
I moved out here because I knew a lot of people in Sonoma County. And I had lived in Southern California before. And knew that, you know, to carry the Detroit analogy further, if you took Detroit, hit it with a fly swatter, you'd get Los Angeles. Just spread it out.
Yep. It is sprawling.
Well, and in the 70s, it was nasty.
Yeah.
I mean, Los Angeles has gone through a renaissance. I was just down there for the California Bicycle Summit.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but go ahead.
Oh, the city is gorgeous now. I mean, they've gone through a complete renaissance.
Nice.
It was not gorgeous in the 70s.
No. No, it was not. So you went out. You went out there. You left Boston and the Merlin people. And tell me where Arctos Machines came in. Your fabulous jig that the frame builders still say is one of the finest on the market.
It's from the Latin name for Manzanita, Arctostophilus.
Okay.
It was the only thing that would grow in our yard for a while.
Okay. I'm trying to figure this out, you know? Anyway, you have been referred to as the mad scientist and a brilliant metallurgist.
Somebody called me an underachieving genius.
Well, I think a lot of people are underachieving geniuses, but
I don't know if I'd call myself mad yet. I was.
Wait, you were and you're not yet. So
right. That was before I did bicycles, when I did other things.
Okay. Like crazy things.
Yeah.
Like you were a groupie for Aerosmith. No, you were a roadie for Aerosmith.
No, groupie, that's a different gender.
You're right. Yeah, you're right.
They perform a different function. Yeah.
We're not going there.
Yeah.
You were a roadie, though.
I actually ran the road crew.
And so how did that happen? I think that's a really cool story.
I was 19 years old and was going to college, just started going to college.
Where?
And at Emerson in Boston.
Yep.
It was a theater arts school. And was working, doing sound at a nightclub, Paul's Mall. And so I got an offer to, so here was what was facing me, was you're 19 years old. Do you want to go back to school for the next semester or go off with a rock and roll band and snort your body weight in coke every week?
Let's
see. It
takes
about 30 seconds to make that decision when you're 19.
Okay.
So that was it. It was like running off of the circus.
Exactly. And I would imagine a rock band is sort of like a circus. How long did you do that?
Well, I did that for 10 years. I didn't work for them for 10 years. You are only working when they're on the road.
Right.
I mean, when they're in the studio, there's other folks involved. And so I went out on the road with a pretty wide variety of bands. I mean, the range from Frank Zappa to,
my
favorite. To, on the other hand, the Captain and Tennille.
Wait a minute. Did you really travel with Frank Zappa?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I built a PA. In fact, this was one of the most fun jobs I had, was to build a PA system that was going to be used at there was a traditional Halloween concert that happened in Los Angeles, and so we made a PA system that looked like a pumpkin, like a pile of gigantic pumpkins.
Cool. I am a huge Frank Zappa fan.
Well, good. No one has ever asked me what it was like, though, to listen to Muskrat Love every night.
Well, I guess anything can get old if you listen to it long enough, huh?
Well, that was the Captain and Tennille.
I can't diss Captain and Tennille. They were popular when they were, but they sure weren't Frank Zappa. And
the
mothers of invention.
There were lots of... Just popularity doesn't make something good. I mean, otherwise, Thomas Kinkade would be Rembrandt.
That's a good point. Very good. So, you know what I want to talk about now, don't you?
Bicycles.
I do want to talk about bicycles, but not a whole lot. I want to talk about the Dumpster Classic.
Oh, that was held in my backyard.
Well, explain what it was. I used to call it something else. There was something called a Huffy Toss years ago.
Well, the Huffy Toss was a completely different and separate event that happened in Bolton, Vermont.
Okay.
The Huffy Toss was actually more epic than the Dumpster Classic. The Dumpster Classic occurred because my backyard in Somerville was... It's a good thing the EPA never discovered. I guess that's when machines were used up in the shop at Fat City, they just went into my backyard.
I see.
It was a lot cheaper than actually getting rid of them. And so we at first set up a trials course, and then we decided to set up a whole criterium course around the house and through the backyard and through the junk and into the basement shop and out again. And a lot of people were seriously injured, and that's just part of the fun. The crowd was encouraged to shoot bottle rockets at people as they came around. Enormous amounts of alcohol and other substances were involved.
It sounds like it. It would have to be.
And we had some fun events, like it's the first and only time that I was able to beat Joe Murray in a hill climb.
And that's because he was disabled?
Well, no. We said, why don't we do it like horse racing, where everyone races at the same weight.
Ah.
And I'm been accused of being gravitationally challenged. And I said, how about we're going to use as the racing weight 300 pounds. You and your bike, we just put weight on your bike,
sure,
until you and your bike weigh 300 pounds.
Got it.
Well, I can hit that with a cruiser and about 10 pounds in the basket.
Got it.
With Joe, it's like double his body weight,
right,
on the bike.
Right.
And we just did a one-block hill climb, and he couldn't keep the bike upright.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this titanium bike that you, like, heaved. Didn't you heave a titanium bike in your Dumpster Classic?
Oh, yeah. Well, although most of the heaving happened at the Huffy Toss. That's where we did the serious heaving.
Okay.
We did flatten a titanium bike and put it in the wall of somebody's house.
Oh, really?
And that one we called the Flat Chance. Because this was before we started Merlin. We were all still working at Fat City.
Yeah, at Fat City. Oh, my goodness. Is it still in the house?
I think so. It was in Gwyn's house, who was one of the partners of,
right,
Merlin.
Right. Does Gwyn still live in the house?
Still in the wall of his house.
Does Gwyn still live in the house?
I don't know.
Wow, that's hilarious.
But I'll bet you it's still in the wall of the house.
So that means that's like, you know, tearing down your walls and finding money in your house. Now you're going to find this titanium frame. Is it the whole bike or just a frame?
Just a frame.
Cool.
But, you know, it's only 3 pounds of titanium, so.
Yeah. It's not worth much.
It's worth $100.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Maybe.
Exactly. Except for its classic value that it was built during such an interesting era.
That's true, but the actual intact rideable bikes seem to be more valuable.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess we should talk a little bit about what you see for the future of bicycling, regardless of what happened back in Somerville. Do you see that we're going to ever get bicycling as the national pastime it used to be? I mean, for people to not just recreate and commute and ride and race, you know, bicycling has so many little spokes on its hub. It's hard for people to pigeonhole it, and so I'm afraid it's never going to be well received by everybody, especially drivers.
Well, here's what I hope is going to happen, is that in the future, everybody will have transportation choice. that you won't be obligated to use a car. You use a car because you want to use a car. Right now, driving is an obligation. You basically can't work in the United States in most places unless you own a car.
That's true.
I mean, the exception would be some place like New York City that is just really dense and has phenomenal public transit. But, you know, you combine that, which I really see is going to be the future, with a growing awareness that active transportation is probably the single biggest key to taking care of our public health epidemic we have with obesity and heart disease. And it's from a sedentary lifestyle. And you know, this is what drives me crazy about things like electric cars. All electric cars are going to do is take care of the pollution problem. And even then, if you're, say, in the Midwest with a coal-fired power plant, it might be worse. You know, you're going from gasoline to coal. I mean, why not operate a steam locomotive?
Yeah. That's true.
So, you know, some places we did the calculations here because everybody says, "Ooh, we'll put up solar panels." In our little county here, which only has 500,000 people in it, we would have to put up almost 8,000 acres of solar panels to charge the electric cars if our whole fleet switched over to electric.
So, how would you see this happening? I mean, obviously, you now have your Rails and Trails project and your Rails and Trails and Freeway project. Do you think this will expand?
Well, here's the hardest thing about, you know, you've kind of got two halves of the sustainability equation, and one half is how we live, and that is, you know, you have a well-insulated house, you use sustainable materials, things like that. But that's essentially consuming your way to sustainability. And then there's the part of where we live, and that's hard because that means we're going to have to change our habits, not just buy a Prius or, buy some PV. But I think people are going to do it simply because to not do it, the consequences are too dire. That I don't think people say, you know, I really like living 40 miles from where I work, and I love that hour and a half of time on the interstate that I get every day, just me and 30,000 other people stuck in traffic. I get off on that. People hate that. People don't want to be doing it. People want to spend time with their families. And the thing about active transportation, which is walking and biking both, is it's the only type, you know, transit's not the answer. Transit is part of the answer, but the problem with transit is it's still encourages great distances between where you work and where you live and a disconnect from your community.
So you're saying people are going to have to move back in toward the city, that these outer ring suburbs are going to shrink a little and this rural thinking is also going to shrink?
Well, or the other way around, that you're going to move. It's generally easier to get a little bit creative with your zoning and allow businesses to move near to residential areas.
Aha.
Getting people to pick up and move their household is a lot harder because there's a lot of emotion involved with that. And a business is just whether or not it pencils out. If it makes sense, a business will make a decision just based on the money.
That's true.
So if you've got a concentrated workforce somewhere, generally speaking, I mean, what keeps businesses where they are is just land use regulations. And we aren't in the era where having a job meant working in a mill somewhere. Usually, I mean, is a software development company really incompatible with a residential subdivision?
Probably not.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make any noise. It doesn't make any pollution. It has high-paying jobs. It would just mean that you would have your residential subdivision. It would have a low-rise office building in it that would employ a lot of the people that work there. And then that, in turn, would generate a lot of satellite businesses. I mean, the people need to go someplace to eat. Then you take the final step is then you need to finally make it a real place. You need a civic area. You need a town center. A lot of these ring suburbs aren't even incorporated in most places. I mean, they aren't municipal corporations. They're out in county land.
Living in the Cleveland area, it's not like that. So, you know, I'm trying to understand what you're saying based on what I know. And so I don't know much outside of Northeast Ohio in terms of how government works with these suburbs. We are all incorporated and we're all beholden to Cleveland for water, for example. It's an interesting study. It's very different from what you're saying, but
right.
I can understand what you're saying. And it makes sense to me to create community around residents.
Well, and I look at the almost the opposite is going back to Boston, where the place was so, eastern Massachusetts was so heavily developed so long ago that there really wasn't an opportunity for anything to sprawl. There wasn't any open space to sprawl to. I mean, centuries ago, those towns were built out right to the next town over.
Right.
So Massachusetts was lucky in that it has very, very self-contained medium to small-sized towns and cities that are economically independent from each other. I mean, that would be a nice place to be, but I don't know if we want to wait the 200 years or so it takes
exactly.
for that to evolve.
Exactly.
And then, you know, the Midwest is kind of a middle ground where, you know, here's an oddity in California, is it's not legal to create a village, a town, a borough. The only legal municipal corporation in California is a city.
And
period.
That requires so much population, right?
Exactly. And,
right.
And so what happens out here that's awful is you create these big, I think of them as population zits. and finally, you get 50,000 people or so living on septic systems out in the country, and that's enough people to be economically viable to incorporate. But then the whole city has been created without any planning, without any thought. It's
right.
just that enough people have coalesced in one area.
I
to
got
be,
it.
You know, and there's enough property taxes to support the thing, but it isn't really a city. It's just a place that a lot of people live.
And so there's nothing really to support it in terms of civic, like museums and, you know, orchestras and...
Oh, no, I'm talking more basic, like schools.
Oh, even like schools. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh.
Or garbage collection. I mean, you know, the real
basic. Yeah, basic stuff, sure. Well, you know what? I'll bet we could talk about this for the next 10 hours.
We could, and that's what I did for the last 6 years. I was a planner. And
got it.
I was on the policy side, so we did, you know, our shop was the group that was responsible for developing the land use regulations in the county, and it's something I'm fairly passionate about. The problem is in today's economy, those are the first... Long-range planning is always what you get rid of because it doesn't generate any permit fees.
I see. Well, I'm glad you came back to the bicycle side because I think you have a lot to add.
Well, I never left, really.
No, I guess not. Are you going to be at the bike summit?
I am.
Well, we should meet up and sit down and have another chat. How's that?
We should.
All right. Well,
absolutely.
It's been wonderful talking to you, getting to know you.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Okay.
Have a great night.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that encore presentation of an interview with Gary Helfrich from 2011. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back to hear my interview with Jeff Speck about his book, Walkable City. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is the last of our encore presentations for this evening. My guest is Jeff Speck. He is the author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. He's a city planner. This conversation is from 2013. I hope you enjoy it. We're going to head on down to Washington, D.C. again. We're going to talk with Jeff Speck. He's the author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. Jeff, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Would you give us a little background on the work that you do and how this book came about?
So I'm a city planner. I was trained in architecture. And, you know, I never thought that I would be the walkability guy. You know, it wasn't the term that I was ever using. If you had told me a couple decades ago or even one, you know, decade ago that I'd have a book on walking, I would have kind of laughed because, you know, I was thinking of things from aesthetic terms or from design terms. But what I found in working on a bunch of downtown plans, mostly for mayors, because I've worked with a lot of mayors over the years, is that the argument kept getting framed, at least in the public discussion. It wasn't being framed as urban design. It wasn't being you know, discussed as you know, what we were calling new urbanism or what others were calling neo-traditional town planning or neighborhood-based planning. It was being called walkable planning. And they weren't necessarily using that term, but most of the mayors and other city leaders that I was working with were judging the success of their cities, and particularly their mixed-use center cities, on the presence or absence of street life. And they understood that if they could generate street life, they would begin to have the sort of downtown part of the city that would thrive and potentially lift the whole city up with it.
So let me ask a question that didn't occur to me until you just said what you said. So I live in Cleveland. Downtown Cleveland saw everybody sort of leave. You know, all the big department stores are gone. Now we have this casino. But does the retail come back because the city's been changed, or does the city change because of so being in retail my whole life,
right.
That was one of the things. I opened a retail store downtown right. in 1989, and we were the first new retail in the Warehouse District of Cleveland for years.
Yep.
And we couldn't make it down there.
No, and I totally understand your question, and it's one that I get a lot. The retail doesn't come back because the city's changed. The retail comes back because the residential comes back because the city's changed.
Okay.
And what you find in most American downtowns now that are improving is that you have to cross a certain, you know, threshold. There's a critical mass of downtown residents that you need to achieve. I'm not going to say what it is because every time I hear it, it's a different number.
Sure.
But there's a certain critical mass you need for a supermarket. There's a certain critical mass you need for, you know, better restaurants. This discussion is an old one, and it's one that Jane Jacobs even had with the death and life of great American cities 50 years ago when she was remarking at the time, remarking on how Wall Street had no good restaurants and no good gyms because it takes both daytime and nighttime clientele
exactly.
to float those businesses. And, you know, what we've seen in some of the cities I'm working in that are coming back, like Oklahoma City, you know, a taxi driver as recently as a year ago told me, oh, there's no retail in downtown Oklahoma City. Well, in fact, there was some. Now there's a heck of a lot more because it's been a decade now that they've been adding housing. And the retailers respond to the housing just as they did when they packed up their shop
right, and went
out to the suburbs.
Sure. I see. Well, that certainly makes sense to me. So let's talk a little bit about the millennials, the generation that's coming up and that are – because obviously – and then I also want to talk about seniors. But yeah. from the perspective of the brain drain that we're seeing in cities like Cleveland, yeah. where we educate these people in some of the finest institutions in the world, and then they go, okay, I'm going to fill in the blank, Portland, Seattle, you know, St. Louis, other places – they're not buying cars. They don't care about driving.
Yep.
So how has that changed, and what does it mean when it comes to sustainability and transportation?
Well, it's changed. Well, obviously, it's much more sustainable that this generation is driving less. Interestingly, the demographers say that it's a cultural shift, not an economic shift. You know, it's not just brought on by the fact that gas has gotten more expensive and our economy has weakened. You know, these were the kids that grew up watching Friends and Seinfeld and Sex and the City, as opposed to my generation, which grew up watching, you know, The Partridge Family, The Brady Bunch, Happy Days, all of these suburban shows.
Sure.
Chris Leinberger, The Economist, points that out, that this is a generation that aspires to live in cities. When I was a kid, one out of 12 19-year-olds did not have a driver's license. Now one out of four 19-year-olds does not have a driver's license. And if you poll millennials, fully 64% of them will it's not a poll, it's a fact that fully 64% of them move to where they want to be, then they look for a job. which is very different from my generation. And 77% of them in polls will tell you that they want to live in America's urban cores. And by the way, I tell the story in my book of a company, I believe it's called Brand Muscle. If I'd known you were in Cleveland, I would have researched this, that moved their headquarters from a far-flung suburb to downtown Cleveland.
Right. And it was, I think it was from Solon into Cleveland.
Okay. Because their, you know, largely 20-something workforce
right.
Wanted to, you know, live, work, play in downtown Cleveland. And I interviewed a employee there on the phone, and she made it very clear. She gave me some wonderful quotes about how everything they want is right on their doorstep and that their quality of life is so much better now that they're based in a downtown area.
Given that explanation and given the fact that it's not about the economics of owning a car, it's about, actually, it may be, it's that I don't want to spend my money on a car. I want to spend my money on other things.
Yep.
How does a city like Cleveland, and I'm going to use it as a good example because there are a lot of things going on here and
right.
I'm here,
right.
start to add the things that these people want, and then what happens to the suburbs? That's
right.
really one of the questions that I had.
Well, what these people want are good transit connections, which Cleveland is doing a lot to improve, and they want, obviously, much better walkability, which Cleveland is doing some things to improve, and they certainly, most certainly, want better and marked and exuberant bicycle facilities, so, which Cleveland isn't doing anywhere near as much as it could to improve. And most American cities I work in, there are a few notable exceptions, cities that have demonstrated that limited investments in cycle infrastructure have dramatic outcomes in how many more people choose to cycle. But most American cities like Cleveland are only making a half-hearted commitment to the sort of, you know, marked and separated bicycle lanes, protected lanes that will actually get women and children to bicycle in great numbers. When we know that actually with biking it's a strength and it's a safety in numbers theory, and that you only get bike safety when enough people are biking that the drivers kind of expect to see them.
Right.
And then the amazing, you know, doubling multiple times over of the number of bikers we've seen in New York City, the fact that Portland, Oregon, went from being just like the rest of America to biking 15 times as much as the rest of America over 20 years because of $65 million, a lot of money that they invested in cycling. But that's $65 million over 25 years, and that's half the price of one highway Cloverleaf. So, you know, these investments may seem like a lot, but compared to automotive infrastructure or transit infrastructure, they're minuscule, and they dramatically change the lifestyles of the people in these cities. One amazing fact I just heard about Portland is that, you know, a mere decade ago, they were not so different from the rest of the country in that only about 10% of kids walked or biked to school. But as of this year, 37% of kids in Portland are walking or biking to school. And it's a direct outcome of investments in cycling infrastructure. And think about all the savings that constitutes in other categories, and, of course, the health benefits as well.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Speck about his new book, Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. I found the book fascinating. I have to admit, I haven't finished the whole thing because there's a lot in there. It's like chock full. So there is some argument that all these bikes cause more accidents. Let's just talk about that for a second.
Well, you probably know this more than I do, but the clear evidence from city to city is that you might get a slight uptick in the number of accidents as the cycling goes up. Although in some cities, cycling seems to go up with no uptick in the number of accidents. But generally, the number of accidents goes up a bit, and the frequency of accidents goes down because you have many more cyclists. Then you reach a certain threshold. Again, not nameable, but there's
right.
a certain threshold where the average driver starts to begin to expect to see cyclists in the street, and then the number of accidents drops off quite precipitously. The experience, of course, in countries like Holland, where no one wears a helmet, is that bike injuries are quite rare. Now, there's a way that your society changes when you get to that point. You know, in Holland, they teach drivers when they're exiting the vehicle to reach over with their right hand across their waist to open the door because that causes them to look behind them for cyclists. So, you know, we haven't reached that point yet.
Wow, that's a really cool idea.
Yeah. What we see what we see in the American cities like Portland or even more so Davis, California, is that, you know, when everyone expects cyclists, the cyclists are much safer.
I want to talk a little bit about cities and schools, because if we're going to live in the city, we're going to have our children go to schools in the city. And I grew up in Cincinnati, which is very small. And, you took a bus downtown and took 15 minutes. But I did have the school around the corner and I walked there. So what happens when you actually get younger people who are now young families living in the city? What happens with the schools and getting kids to school not being driven?
Schools are the last thing to come. And, you know, I almost wish you didn't bring it up. Because
okay. We can forget that.
But I say that for the humor value, because everybody brings it up. And it's the last thing we need to discuss. Because, you know, the best neighborhoods and the ideal from any planner's perspective or politician's perspective or human's perspective, the ideal community is one that includes all age groups.
True.
You know, and David Byrne says, you know, if we design a city that works for our children, we design one that works for everybody. And these are all true statements. But I don't ask myself, you know, what is the perfect city? I ask myself, what can we do to help our current cities thrive? And most of our current cities, particularly in their downtown areas, this is not the problem they're facing. The problem they're facing is, you know, recovering from a massive disinvestment and the fact that almost nobody lives downtown in the first place. And they're poised to accept vast numbers of millennials who want the urban life. And as you were going to ask me, vast numbers of empty nesters who have no more desire for or use or capacity to float the expense of a big house with a big yard with a school system that their kids aren't in anymore, right?
Right.
And so what our cities need now and are poised to accept if they can just provide what these people want is the influx of population that will occur as these two huge demographic bubbles that dwarf all others, the millennials and the front-end boomers, as they begin to move back downtown because they can have a better life downtown. Now, what you find in cities like Portland and like Washington, D.C., where that influx has been happening for quite some time, is that perhaps 15 years after these people move in, the schools achieve some degree of quality. Now, it happens differently in different places. In Washington, D.C., where our system has famously failed many times over, we're seeing a charter school network arise, which is actually larger than the number of kids, you know, public charter schools.
Right.
We now have more kids in public charter school than we have in just the plain old public schools. And one can imagine a future in which every school is a charter school. And, in fact, the head of the public schools just applied this year to have chartering authority so that she can make charter schools compete against her own public schools.
Interesting.
I have to say, from a city planning perspective, and as a parent whose wife trucks his kid to and from school, that it's really bad because schools are no longer located in neighborhoods.
Right.
So everyone is commuting, and the commute is twice as bad because there's kids commuting as well as adults, and it's disruptive to communities, and it's disruptive to the way that communities used to form around schoolyards, and you'd get to know each other as parents and then as neighbors. So it's not ideal, but the point I want to make is that, you know, schools are the last thing to come, but they're the last thing that most cities need to improve right now if they're going to thrive in the short term. To thrive in the short term, they need to have the environment that's going to welcome the young laptoppers and the empty nester laptoppers.
Right.
We'll take it from there.
You already brought it up, and I brought it up. Let's talk about people like me who are starting to retire, and when the choices used to be assisted living or move in with your kids or move into what I remember were called old age homes, which was
right.
Just an obnoxious comment as far as I'm concerned. Many of us want to remain independent. We don't want a car necessarily. So how will the cities need to revive themselves to be accessible to an older generation?
What you're remembering is old age homes are in fact a rather modern invention, and prior to the middle of the 20th century, with the advent of sprawl, Most elders just retired in place.
True.
Because the place that they lived in provided a convenient walk to the corner store and to maybe the department store and to, of course, many places to eat and drink and shop and get your hair done. Back in the 80s, sociologists discovered, quote-unquote discovered, something that they called a NORC, a naturally occurring retirement community. And the first place so identified was the Upper East Side of New York City, where basically wealthier elderly people of means were all flocking because they could afford to, and it offered them a tremendously independent and productive lifestyle that they couldn't get in a environment that would require car ownership as a right of citizenship, which is, of course, what we find in most of America, that, you know, we have all these seniors struggling, you know, fighting not to give up their car keys when they really should, but they know that the minute they lose their car, they lose their viability as citizens, and they become dependent on other people or they get shipped to the home. So what we find is that more and more elders and empty nesters planning ahead, when offered a decent, safe, walkable version of downtown, are making the choice to move to downtowns. And you may have read in the book that my parents made this exact choice a
right.
couple years ago when they moved from, you know, leafy Belmont Hill, Massachusetts, to also leafy but much more urban Lexington Center,
right.
Massachusetts, where they're on, you know, they're on Massachusetts Avenue, and there's, you know, probably 30 to 40 different businesses right down the stairs, the front stairs from their condominium. And by the way, they paid as much for the two-bedroom condominium as they got selling their four-bedroom house. That reflects the fact that people are paying a premium to live in walkable areas.
And we are talking East Coast, you know, Massachusetts, too, which is just an expensive place to live. But
yeah.
the truth
it's
is
all
that
relative.
It is all relative. So you did some sort of a massive talk with a bunch of big city mayors. And what did you find were the biggest objections to making the changes necessary to make an old city like Cleveland, for example, desirable for the future?
What I did was for 4 years I was the director of design at the National Endowment for the Arts, and I oversaw a program called the Mayor's Institute on City Design. And so every 2 months, somewhere in the U.S., we would gather up eight mayors, usually mid-sized city or bigger mayors, and then eight designers, often who I would get to pick. Each mayor would bring their most pressing urban design challenge, like, you know, how do I reconnect to my waterfront, or where do I put my convention center? And we'd lock ourselves in a room for 2 days, solid, you know, all of our meals together. We'd really get to know each other, and we'd try to solve each mayor's most pressing challenge. And what I learned from this experience was that, you know, discovering with these mayors that their city was being designed accidentally, day by day, by their public works department, that absent a mayor or some other generalist top-down saying, what is the kind of city we want? What is the kind of city we want to be? That instead, public works directors responding principally to the complaint of there's too much traffic or the complaint that there's not enough parking were wrecking the cities in order to satisfy these demands, which actually you can't satisfy. And if there's been one major lesson learned from the latter, you know, second half of the 20th century in America, it's that when you give the car more room, it demands yet more room, be it for driving or for parking. And there's a very complex, and I talk about it in my book, Walkable City. There's a very complex but, indisputable economic law behind that, which is that because we're not paying the true costs of driving and we're not paying the true costs of parking, they're what economists refer to as a free good. And when you're presented with a free good, of course, demand goes through the roof.
Sure.
The expression is, of course, there's not enough parking. If pizza were free, would there be enough pizza? And so, you know,
analogy.
The public works department, you know, bless their little hearts, trying to satisfy the biggest public complaints they're hearing, which are about not enough lanes and not enough parking spaces, have reamed out our downtowns, made them so much worse than they were before. The cities that decided to do this more are the places that you want to be in less, clearly, and vice versa. And so what these mayors were learning, and me along with them, was that, you know, we have to decide first what kind of city we want to be. We have to decide, you know, where traffic will go and at what speed. We have to decide whether we want two lanes of congestion, four lanes of congestion, or eight lanes of congestion. You know, we can pick, because the experience is that, you know, you build what you want, the cars respond, and if you do it the other way, serving the automobile, you will just become its slave.
I'm speaking with Jeff Speck. He is the author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. And the last thing I want to talk about is some of the examples of, you say it can be quick and it can be easy. Can you give us some examples of the simple and inexpensive things that might be done to make an area more walkable and bikeable?
Certainly, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, one of the, I call it the great epidemic of the 60s was this one-waying of streets in the downtowns of our cities. I don't think Cleveland suffered from it as much as other cities.
You mean going one way on one street and one way on the other street?
Yeah, the
drives you crazy.
The replacement of what was once a two-way street network in every American downtown with these one-way pairs, which were inserted with the objective, just like the way that highways were reamed through cities, they were inserted with the actual expectation that if we make it easier for people to get in and out of the city will thrive. Well, of course, we saw what happened. People decided just not to live in the city at all because it was easier for them to get in and out of it. And the cities, you know, decanted all of their residents and their wealth to the suburbs. So one thing that we've seen in a lot of cities is the reversion of these one-way pairs back to the two-ways that they once were. And you can document in city after city the number of businesses that evaporated when these two-ways became one-way. And in a number of cities, and I've got the statistics from Savannah in my book, when they turned a one-way back to two-way, the number of new businesses that arrived almost immediately. So that's one great thing that we're doing. The typical condition, though, to answer your question, is that, interestingly, while certain cities have certain streets that are congested, many cities that I work in, the Oklahoma cities, the Cedar Rapids, the Grand Rapids, actually have streets that were oversized at a time of either greater population or in anticipation of greater population that never came. And when you look at the car counts and you look at the number of lanes, you find that many of these streets have twice the number of lanes they need. And so I've done it once in Oklahoma City, and I'm doing it right now in Cedar Rapids, turning essentially four-lane systems, half of the streets of which are one-way, back to two-lane systems. And what you find when you change a four-lane street to a two-lane street is that you can add back, for example, the parallel parking that was removed.
Right.
And parallel parking is this barrier of steel that protects the sidewalk. It's essential for pedestrians. You can add in bike facilities where there are none. You know, in Oklahoma City there were none, and now we have half-built a system of, you know, a thorough network of bike lanes throughout the downtown. You can do other things that are more expensive, like move curbs and put in street trees. But my admonition to cities is, you know, let's do it as cheaply as possible. Let's not build anything. Let's lay down a new top coat and just restripe and reallocate the street among driving, parking, and biking in a way that causes businesses to thrive, that welcomes bikers in much greater numbers, and encourages cars to drive at the proper speed. Because right now, with the excess lanes, they're often driving at highway speeds rather than downtown speeds.
Yeah, like 40 instead of 25.
Well, you know, a 12-foot lane is a 70-mile-an-hour lane, and the standard in most cities is 12-foot lanes. It used to be 10 feet.
Right.
But the highway engineers were allowed to write the rules for designing downtown streets. And now your typical downtown lane is a 70-mile-an-hour lane. And no wonder everyone speeds, because the road is telling you to.
A lot of the trails, rails trails, for example, now, of course, rail trail is also looking at access along existing light rail or, you know, corridors. Now they're using corridors in urban areas, not just going out into the suburbs and into the rural areas.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of trails that are built. There's a lot of infrastructure built that doesn't go anywhere, that has no connection to anything. And
you mean bike trails?
Yeah. Yeah, specifically bike and walking. We could call them all-purpose trails if you want. Right. For example, now, if you were in Cleveland and you went all the way downtown, I don't know if anybody took you through our what's called the Emerald Necklace. It's like 108 miles that rings the city of these beautiful parks. And there are, you know, these trails on these parks. But, you know, getting that works. But getting from, say, where I live, which is quote-unquote east side, to downtown Cleveland – you can't do it yet,
right?
Because you have snippets of trail. So,
well, first of all, in terms of strictly pedestrian trails, and maybe there's no such thing unless it's too bumpy to bike on. You know, I'm not a huge advocate of trails as opposed to urban walking. David Owen, who wrote Green Metropolis, which is an amazing book that explains why the Americans with the lightest carbon footprint live in Manhattan. You know, he says, trails are a great thing if you want to convince people to take walks. In other words, recreate
right.
walking. But what we really need to focus on is what I describe as the useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting walk, the walk that happens between your house and the shop or your business and the restaurant that causes you to walk because it's simply the most convenient and useful thing to do. Now, in terms of bike trails, obviously, you know, any bike improvements that you set out to do should be done in light of a regional plan that connects these things into regional scale corridors. However, I often find that a bike lane is just a darn good way to use up excess pavement. So I do find in cities that I'm often laying in bike lanes that may only last 8 or 10 blocks just because for 8 or 10 blocks a street has an extra 10 feet that I don't want dedicated to cars that are going too fast.
Got it.
So I see this serving two purposes. And actually, there's a third purpose, too, which is as an advertisement for your city. So one thing I tell the cities I work in, and often I'm presenting to the mayor or to the city council, is, you know, don't think of it as just a bike lane. First of all, paint it bright green or some bright color, the full width of the lane, make it as bold as you can, right? But then don't think of it as just a bike facility. Think of it as a horizontal billboard that says we are a healthy city, we're a progressive city, we're a young city, we're a city that welcomes millennials, we're a place that you want to be. Because that's the message it really sends, and it's probably money much better spent than in any sort of Chamber of Commerce, mailings that you could send out.
Wow, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me. Everything was interesting. The book, again, Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time by Jeff Speck. He's in Washington, D.C. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me on the show. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you, and I really enjoyed the questions.
I'm glad you did. All right. Well, I will catch up with you again.
Thanks again.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was my conversation with Jeff Speck from 2013. If you're interested in his book, it is available at all the usual places, Walkable City. So I hope you enjoyed the show. We will be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be talking with frame builder Johnny Coast from New York City. Johnny will also be exhibiting at the Philly Expo next weekend at the Philadelphia Convention Center Friday and Saturday. So I hope you have a great week. Remember, you can always follow us on Facebook, leave us a tweet at Outspoken without an E, or make a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Remember to stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.